From WRTI and the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts, this is Creatively Speaking.
Hello, this is Jim Cotter. This morning we listen back to a special edition of our program, Viva la Diva, when we had the privilege of speaking with two of the world's great sopranos, Renee Fleming.
Insofar as an artist can come on stage and transcend who they are to create art and touch and move the audience, I hope I'm a diva.
And Kerry Takanawa.
My career has been everything I've ever wanted it to be. I have no desire to do anything else.
In our regular perusal of the Culture File section of GoPhila.com, we honor the legacy of another great female singer with a visit to the Marian Anderson Historical Residence and Museum. And in I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, we answer that interminable question, what makes a good voice a great voice? That's all I have this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
In the past 10 years, soprano Renee Fleming has emerged as the most popular and renowned female singer of her generation. Her biography reads like a roll call of great performances. She has adoring fans in every corner of the globe who flock to see her performances on the operatic stage, in concert or recital, and on radio and television. With each new recording, she leaves the critics searching for new superlatives to describe the great breadth and depth of her awesome talent. Yet none of this seemed likely when Renee Fleming began her musical career more than 20 years ago. She struggled to find roles that would showcase her growing talent. Then she met Christoph Eschenbach in Houston in 1988, and everything began to fall into place. He recognized her as a great emerging talent and worked to help her realize her potential. We spoke with Renee Fleming last October, prior to her season opening night performance with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Christoph and I met during a production of The Marriage of Figaro in Houston. It was both of our debuts, actually, with the Houston Grand Opera. He was the newly appointed music director of the Houston Symphony and, you know, decided to walk across the street and also conduct some opera. And this was my big break. This was my first engagement in a house of that standing and of that reputation. But the thing that happened with Christoph is because we had the available time at that point, had a decent rehearsal period, he worked with me every single day. And, you know, I was nervous and I was fresh and very young, and it was kind of a great opportunity for both of us to get to know each other. And he was so generous with his time. And one of the things a great conductor will do is require an artist to take risks and push us and encourage us to go beyond our sense of our own limitations, and he's always done that in spades, whether through a luxurious tempo or through certain kind of phrasing, and all the great conductors do that. So it paid off in a sense that the performance was successful, and after that, we just started premiering all kinds of things together, several Strauss roles for me, several Mozart roles, other concert repertoire, and we developed a very close musical relationship and friendship as a result.
You have, I believe, described Richard Strauss as your desert island composer. You're performing the four last songs of the Kimmel on Tuesday. Correct me if I'm wrong, you don't generally like to return to repertoire very much, yet Strauss has been preeminent in your repertoire over the years. Why are you so comfortable with that particular composer, do you think?
Well, Four Last Songs is, first of all, it's such a great concert piece. I mean, it's my favorite concert piece, and one of the greatest ever composed for the soprano voice. Strauss loved the soprano voice. His particular vocal writing in the repertoire that I sing, it suits me perfectly. It could have been composed for me. I mean, the Four Last Songs is one of the pieces that I could kind of get out of bed and sing in the morning. And so that's the telltale sign. That means it's a perfect fit.
Today's program is a special. We've called it Viva la Diva because it contains not only yourself but also Dame Kerry Takanawa. Diva is not a phrase that you're very fond of.
Well, it's unfortunately today it has two things. One, somewhat negative connotations in our world, and two, it's taken a much, much larger meaning, and it now applies mostly to pop singers in the public's eye and in the ear. And, you know, people have forgotten that it was ever an opera reference. So I think it's better to leave it to the side. I mean, it does, you know, in its original form mean goddess. I mean, insofar as an artist can come on stage and transcend who they are to create art and touch and move the audience, I hope I'm a diva. I mean, I hope that I fit that bill. I certainly try to. but the rest of it, I think, can stay firmly in some other place.
I don't in any way want to appear sycophantic, but as world famous as you are and as well regarded as you are, you're still incredibly grounded. Was there ever temptation, or is it in your nature that the ego would have taken over, that you would have become diva-esque in any way off stage?
Well, my theory about that is that people are either prone to that syndrome or they're not. And I've seen young singers who are, and I've watched them change, quickly. And I think it has to do with a personality issue. It has to do with who they are by nature, in a sense. And I even tried. I went through a period where I felt really badly about not being diva-esque, about not being more temperamental, not being kind of, I wanted to be the fodder of dinner conversations so badly. And try as I might, I could never get anything more than, oh, yeah, Renee Fleming, isn't she nice? And I hated that, and I've just since come to accept it, and I've just decided, well, it's who I am, and so there you have it. And maybe I can excel in other areas.
There is a theory also abroad that the greater the talent, the smaller the ego.
Well, I have to say, when I've met people who do reach the top of their fields in any kind of world, they tend to be pretty wonderful. And one can say, why wouldn't they be? They've achieved what they set out to achieve. There's not the frustration. There's no bitterness. There's none of the negativity that climbs into it. A lot of us, and myself included, tend to be insecure, but that doesn't necessarily turn us into monsters.
You're now, although my mother will not be pleased that I bring this up, but you're now in your 40s. This is a time when you're getting additional gifts vocally. Anything you've noticed in particular, or is it something that is such a gradual change that it's difficult to perceive?
Well, your mother trained you well. You're very well. At least you said it in a very nice way. Thank you. The difference, what I feel now is a certain stability and a certain trustworthiness, knock on wood, I am superstitious, to the voice, which makes it a joy to sing. It took a long time for my voice to really settle down and know where it wanted to go every day without giving me a tremendous amount of anxiety. What's not happening, interestingly enough, at least not yet, is that the weight that one expects with a more mature sound or that moving into heavier repertoire, that really doesn't seem to be happening.
But I mean,
it's still
even apparent in your speaking voice. I mean, there is a greater resonance there that a 35-year-old simply doesn't have, to my ear at least.
Hmm. Well, I am also at the end of a cold.
Oh, okay.
I'm hearing it today too. I think I sound like a man, actually.
Shall we talk a little bit about the new CD?
Yeah.
Okay. Handel arias. Why was this the time for Renee Fleming to do an album of Handel arias?
Well, I had a fantastic experience with Handel's Alcina a couple of years ago, both in Paris and then in Chicago, and it was such a joy to sing and to create. And Handel is also incredibly popular right now. It's something that has really grabbed the public's imagination, and mine too, partly because musicologists have unearthed so much performance practice that makes the repertoire work better, especially in including early instruments and the use of authentic period orchestras. I mean, there's no question that makes an enormous difference. So, and I enjoy, I love singing it. It's more intimate, too. Handel always interested me. I sang a lot of Handel as a student. And like most people who enjoy music, have the Messiah memorized, all four parts probably. So it was kind of on the list, and eventually we got to it. And I'm thrilled because it was one of the most rewarding and joyous experiences recording this music. It was just heaven for me to sing, and I hope to sing more. So the repertoire was difficult to choose. He was an incredibly prolific composer. I couldn't even get to everything to call my favorites from all of it, but I did get through a lot of repertoire. I had to make the decision ultimately to sing both Italian arias and some of the English repertoire, and a couple of hits, but a lot of lesser known pieces as well. So it was a real labor of love.
Of the lesser known pieces, could you perhaps recommend one that we could play?
Well, Lotario is the one that has never been recorded. I think it's in the process of being recorded right now, the complete opera, maybe. I think that's something I heard. Maybe it's the aria, I'm not sure. But now there will be a couple of versions of it to hear. But this is probably, I think, the first time that it will have been heard other than in a live performance.
Your record label has never pushed you in any sort of crossover direction, which seems to be a great sort of fad of the moment, that you get somebody with classical training and great talent and then try to turn them into a pop star. But you did, if I'm not mistaken, a couple of years ago, talk about doing some jazz. Any thoughts? I mean, has that come to fruition? Is it an avenue you would still consider going down?
Well, I started as a jazz singer. I sang for 2.5 years in a jazz club every weekend when I was a student. And it's always been my hobby and my real kind of side passion as a listener, as a fan. Actually, I just made the recording a couple of weeks ago, so your question is very timely. And I think it will come out in the spring. If we put it all together and it's a disaster, maybe it won't, but the plan is for it to come out this spring.
Can you tell us maybe some of the songs or who played on that, who produced, who was involved in that?
I think I'm not supposed to yet, but it's let's just say it's a very personal, intimate, tiny record with songs that I love, including some classical repertoire, and it's not an especially classical jazz recording. It's a little bit different, so I think it will surprise people.
We look very much forward to it. Renee Fleming, it's been an absolute delight to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure.
No one would question the idea that Marian Anderson was, in the traditional original sense of the word, truly a diva. Yet in her own South Philadelphia neighborhood, she was best known for her modesty. When Anderson would return to Philadelphia after touring the world, she would still sing in her local church choir and take an active interest in her neighborhood. Anderson made a huge impact on one little girl in particular in that South Philadelphia neighborhood.
When she'd come home from her tours, she'd have my mother bring me up here, and she would chat with me. Little Blanche, how are things going? What are you playing now?
Blanche Burton Lyles is a concert pianist and founder and president of the Marian Anderson Historical Society. Lyles bought Marian Anderson's house in 1997 and opened it to visitors. Lyle's mother was the pianist at the Union Baptist Church, where a young Marian Anderson first began singing. Members of the congregation immediately realized that Anderson's voice was so extraordinary it would merit a fund to support her formal training. This fund would ultimately pay for Anderson to train with private teachers in the US and Europe. On her return from Europe, Anderson began a path that would eventually lead to international stardom. In 1924, she bought a home on South Martin Street in South Philadelphia, directly across the street from the church where she had started singing. Phyllis Sims is curator of the Marian Anderson House.
This house she purchased for her mother in 1924, and together they lived here for over 60 years. And this is where she stayed, you know, when she came to Philadelphia.
Late in her life, Anderson married architect Orpheus King Fisher, whom she had befriended when she was 15. Fisher designed the paneling in the parlor room of the house. Visitors to the parlor can peruse photographs of Anderson with Albert Einstein, Paul Robeson, and assorted dignitaries. But as Phyllis Sims walks us through the house, she explains that Anderson did most of her entertaining not in her parlor, but in her basement.
It was fashionable for blacks to fix up their basements because, you know, they weren't allowed to the various restaurants and things during that period. And this is what we call the Marian Anderson Entertainment Center. At the time, of course, there was a bar and table and sofas and chairs.
On the wall in the basement is a photo of Marian Anderson singing to a large crowd at the Lincoln Memorial on what is perhaps her most famous day.
She was in demand, and her concerts had been a sellout. So when she came back here and Howard University tried to find a hall suitable, they said, well, Constitution Hall would be great for the concert. Of course, they didn't allow her to sing there. They had never had a black there, and they weren't about to make an exception. And since Eleanor Roosevelt was a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, who were the keepers of Constitution Hall, resigned. She used her political influence and worked with the Department of Interior, decided they would have it at the Lincoln Memorial and have it open for everyone.
Lyle's labor of love continues today. She recently purchased and is in the process of restoring the house 2 blocks away where Anderson was born. Thanks also to her efforts, this autumn the United States Postal Service will introduce a Marian Anderson commemorative stamp. An award-winning children's book on Anderson called When Marian Sings has been selected by the Philadelphia Board of Education as an outstanding book, and on the day we visited, the house had just received its plaque from the City of Philadelphia, granting it historic status. More information on the Marian Anderson Historical House and Museum is available at the Culture File section of gophila.com. Since her sensational debut as the Countess in The Marriage of Figaro at the Royal Opera House in London's Covent Garden in 1971, Kiri Takanawa has maintained her almost legendary status as one of the world's most famous sopranos. In her more than 30-year career, she has literally done it all. Major roles in all of the world's greatest opera houses, concerts with every significant international orchestra, and an unparalleled recording catalogue. Dame Kiri, she was made a Dame of the British Empire by Queen Elizabeth in 1982, was born in New Zealand and is proud of her heritage as one of that country's native Maori people. There's a reputation which you share that the Maori people have of being very determined and very focused. Do you think that that's a function of you as a personality, or is it something that comes from your background?
I think it's a function of me, because I think sometimes along the line you have to be given the opportunity to be focused and determined. And it's not always in people's hands, really. I mean, it all depends. I had a career to pursue. Little did I know it at the time, but I did have a career to pursue and did. And so I was able to become focused and very determined as to what I wanted. But not everybody gets the opportunity to do that.
You've started a foundation recently to help young singers perhaps pursue the kind of career that you've had.
Yes, my foundation would be for that purpose, yes. Whether it be for classical singers, I must say that I do rather lean more towards the singers because they have only a short window of opportunity, whereas a musician has a much longer duration of career.
You had to go to London to study. Are there now facilities for outstanding young talented musicians to study to a high level in New Zealand?
Well, they certainly, we do have it, but you do have to go and immerse yourself in Europe. That is the place. You know, it chews you up. And once you start experiencing, the continent, Germany, Italy, and all those amazing places, certainly along with England, I would always encourage people to go to England because we have such a wealth of amazing teachers and performances and conductors and people willing to put their efforts into young people. So I would always recommend that they went to Europe.
Are you still doing music that you did earlier in your career? Do you ever grow tired of music? I mean, what's the evolution? Well, how does repertoire change?
I mean, I've dropped some music and suddenly come back to it, and then I will pick something else up because it works out very well to join it up with other composers. But I basically do the things that I just love to do and pianists love to play it. It's a sort of a collaboration between pianist and singer, and just music that we just like to format, and hopefully the audience likes it too.
Has music that you've returned